Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
Big bank earnings are boosting the case for a soft landing despite March turmoil.
What this quarter makes clear is that big banks have some advantages that regional or other banks don't have, which is just very diversified businesses.
And the House narrowly passes a defense bill with what Democrats call culture war amendments. Plus, United Health says more Americans are seeking mental health care. It's Friday, July 14th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. Let's start with big bank earnings. J.P. Morgan Chase saw a 67% increase in profit. That's more than $14 billion. Wells Fargo also reported higher profits, up 57%. Citigroup had a rockier quarter with profits down 36%. Still, all three banks beat analyst expectations. Together, the reports are showing more signs of economic resiliency. So does that mean we're really clear of the March banking crisis? Here now with more is Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street writer Tellus Demos. Welcome, Tellus.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with J.P. Morgan. Really big number there. What drove the big jump in profits?
One of the big drivers was a jump in net interest income. That's the money that J.P. Morgan or any bank basically earns from its lending book and securities and things like that, minus what it pays out to depositors. And despite everything going on where we've been worried about how high interest rates are driving up banks' deposit costs, are impacting consumers and companies, you know, the biggest banks continue to take advantage of higher rates to make more money doing lending. And even though their deposit costs are rising, they're not rising enough to overwhelm the benefit they get from both higher rates in their lending as well as growing their lending overall. So what this quarter makes clear is that big banks have some advantages that regional or other banks don't have, which is just very diversified businesses. And so in cases of banks like Silicon Valley Bank or First Republic, where there were runs of depositors on those banks, in a lot of cases, they would run to the biggest banks. So these big banks did not see the same level of deposit outflows that those other banks did. And again, these biggest banks have some businesses that are really benefiting from this environment right now, like notably their credit card businesses. Big banks are also some of the biggest card lenders, and people are borrowing more on their cards. The rates on card loans are going up, and people are spending a lot on their cards. And so that's a great business for banks, and that continues to help them. That is not a business that a lot of these other kind of regional or specialty banks necessarily had. So it speaks to just the mix of businesses that the various biggest banks have, as well as the fact that in times of crisis, they are often seen as kind of a safe haven rather than just lumped in with banks overall as being part of the problem.
Let's talk more about that. What's driving consumers to borrow, use their credit cards now more? That's a reversal from what we saw during the height of the pandemic, certainly.
During the pandemic, people's accounts were flush. They had a lot of money just sort of at hand. That meant that they didn't have to borrow as much on their cards. Now, people are starting to use down those cushions. I think what the debate will be about that is whether that's a sign of consumer strength. That means that consumers feel good. They are ready to borrow. They want to do more. They feel confident that when they borrow, they'll be able to pay it back. Or whether it's a sign that maybe consumers are needing a little credit to make ends meet, and it could be a sign of stress at some point in the future. But at this point, at least, the rate at which people are late with their card payments, while it's going up a little bit, overall, that's all kind of within what everybody would have expected, given how good people looked during the pandemic. There has been a normalization anticipated, and we're seeing that, but it's not yet at a level where the banks are saying, gosh, we're really seeing worrisome signs about consumer health. They continue to say that their consumer customers look pretty good.
You started to touch on this already, Tellus, but a big question that's been guiding how we look at these reports really since March has been whether the banking crisis is really over. This gave us some insights to the biggest banks. What about the smaller banks? Where has this left them?
Well, I think that there were some things that investors looked at in these biggest bank reports, even though they were mostly quite positive, at least certainly for JP Morgan and for Wells Fargo, who both had big jumps. There are some other things, though, that people feel like maybe will impact other banks. And that is, even at these big banks, the cost of their deposits did rise. Now, again, these banks have lots of ways to offset that. Other banks might not. And so what's interesting is that even though for most of the day, you know, shares of JP Morgan have been trading higher, shares of banks overall have not done very well on Friday. So people maybe are worried that the things that, the big banks can sort of handle and deal with are things that might be more impactful for regional or smaller banks, particularly, I think, in the realm of deposit costs.
So tell us, to wrap this up, bank earnings obviously are seen as a barometer for the economy more broadly. As we're tracking rising interest rates and looking ahead to the next Fed meeting, what do these reports tell us about the strength of the economic recovery or the possibility of a recession?
I think, you know, bank earnings are, like you said, a reflection of what's going on in the economy. And I think that there are some puts and takes that I don't think will be dramatically different from what people have been thinking that the Fed is thinking about. So I'm not sure that the bank earnings this time around will dramatically change the picture. Certainly, though, it does indicate that the very largest banks remain pretty healthy. And so from that point of view, I don't think the Federal Reserve will be worried that further rate increases will impact the biggest banks. They may still be worried about some of the smaller or regional banks, but there's not necessarily anything in these results to tell them, oh my gosh, you've really got to hit the brakes. Or on the other hand, oh my gosh, you've really got to accelerate rate increases.
All right. Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street writer Telus Dimas, thank you so much for breaking this down with me.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Democrats are criticizing the GOP for adding a series of amendments to the defense bill. What it means for the battle ahead after the break.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/itheroes.
The Republican-controlled House has narrowly passed an $886 billion defense policy bill in a vote of 219 to 210. That's after the GOP loaded the bill with controversial amendments that would restrict abortion access, ban transgender health care for troops, and eliminate offices and personnel dedicated to promoting diversity in the military. The Senate is working on its own version of the bill, and lawmakers need to reconcile their differences for the final National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2024. Congressional reporter Lindsay Wise joined me from Capitol Hill to explain what comes next.
I think there's a real question of whether the Congress will be able to pass the National Defense Authorization Act, which is a bill that they have passed for 62 years in a row. The atmosphere up here is obviously very polarized and partisan, and the debate yesterday on this bill got pretty heated. There were some exchanges and jeering and shouting, and an apology had to be issued from one lawmaker who used an outdated term for black people on the floor. So things have gotten pretty tense over here. Now the Senate's going to take up its version of the defense bill probably next week, and they will pass what is most likely to be a more bipartisan bill. So we can expect to see a Senate bill that does not include most of these measures dealing with, you know, abortion restrictions or bans on transgender care or diversity training in the military. We're more likely to see a bipartisan bill pass the Senate.
The Biden administration has announced a plan to forgive $39 billion in federal student debt for more than 800,000 older borrowers. The Education Department says student loan borrowers on income-driven repayment plans who have made 20 or 25 years of payments will get their remaining balances wiped out in the coming weeks. The one-time adjustment is separate from the administration's $430 billion debt forgiveness program, which was struck down by the Supreme Court last month. The Education Department said it's considering ways to provide debt relief to millions of other borrowers. In other news, the Environmental Protection Agency is launching a national green bank, doling out $27 billion in funds from last year's climate law to help low-income communities tackle climate change. Wall Street Journal climate finance reporter Amrith Ramkumar says it's one of the only programs explicitly directing money to poor communities that are vulnerable to climate change.
It partners with the private sector to fund things like electric car chargers, battery storage, and building upgrades. And those projects really don't get funding, particularly in low-income communities. The idea is to bring in private sector funding so that the $20 billion turns into much more than that. The remaining $7 billion will be allocated in a solar competition that the EPA announced last month. This is really important because the climate law created a mountain of tax credits and direct loans, but this is one of the only programs where minority communities, rural communities, Native American tribes, and others that are really vulnerable to climate change can get private sector funding.
The EPA is racing to award the money by September 2024, which is the deadline for allocating it. UnitedHealth says the number of Americans seeking treatment for anxiety, depression, and substance use problems has gone up by double digits since last year. The nation's biggest health insurer believes the shift represents a long-term change. It also said while people feel increasingly comfortable seeking help, it sees a continuing shortage of mental health care providers that's leading to problems with access. The rising use of behavioral health care was one driver of higher health care costs flagged by the company during a call discussing its second quarter financial results, which overall beat analysts' expectations. Drug maker Eli Lilly is spending up to $2 billion to acquire Versanis Bio, a private company developing a potential treatment for obesity. The treatment targets molecules that play a role in the body's accumulation of fat, prompting the body to build muscle and burn fat instead. Lilly is among the leaders in the fast-growing weight loss market. Analysts estimate it'll be worth more than $40 billion worldwide by 2031. And former Fox News host Tucker Carlson and former White House advisor Neil Patel are seeking funds to start a new media company, which would potentially use Twitter as its backbone. That's according to people familiar with the matter. The people said the new company would feature longer versions of the free videos Carlson has been posting regularly on Twitter since his departure from Fox News, but would ultimately be driven by subscriptions. The parent companies of Fox News and of The Wall Street Journal share common ownership. And finally, by this time next week, two highly anticipated summer films will be hitting movie theaters. And they're very different. There's Barbie, a movie bringing the iconic doll to life. And there's Oppenheimer, a gritty biopic about the man behind the atomic bomb. Like I said, pretty different. But as it turns out, many fans are planning to see both, and in some cases, back to back. The idea is going viral online, complete with photoshopped memes combining imagery from the two movies under the name Barbenheimer. Hollywood hopes all the online excitement translates into filled theater seats. As one analyst at Comscore tells freelance writer Izzy Umpiel, 40% of annual box office revenue comes from the summer. And it hasn't been a great season so far.
Hollywood has definitely endured a rough stretch this summer in terms of the box office. The three major movies that they thought would bring in the most sales, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, The Flash, and Elemental, have not brought in as many tickets as expected. And Barbie and Oppenheimer seem to be the two movies with the most fan anticipation behind them. Neither of them are adaptations of prior IP. Neither of them are superhero movies. Neither of them are sequels. Neither of them are affiliated with Marvel or Pixar or any of those name brand studios. And it's unexpectedly these two original films that are maybe going to carry the rest of the season.
One analyst estimated a $35 million to $45 million opening for Oppenheimer, and probably an above $100 million opening for Barbie. And if you are planning to see these movies back-to-back, just so you know, that's about 5 hours runtime. And that's what's news for this week. Our hosts are me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vargas. The show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Kate Bullivant, with help from Mohsen Ali, Anthony Bansi, Julie Chang, Zoe Thomas, and J.R. Whalen. And editorial support from Sandra Kilhoff, Michael Cosmides, Catherine Millsop, Falana Patterson, and Chris Sinsley. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. We'll be back on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.